I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. We begin with Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson, whose latest documentary chronicles the history of black colleges and universities. It will be screened at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum on Sunday and shown on PBS on Monday. We'll have a preview today of Tell Them We Are Rising. Plus, another edition of Whatcha Got Cookin'. Chef Michael Twitty joins me to talk about his latest book, The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History of the Old South. Twitty gets to know his ancestors and himself by cooking, and he calls memory his most indispensable ingredient. Michael Twitty joins me along with David K. Thomas, the executive chef of Ida B's Table, a modern soul food restaurant here in Baltimore. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it. As you've undoubtedly heard, yesterday, about 5:30 in the afternoon, in the trial of the two Baltimore police officers who were part of the Gun Trace Task Force, a jury found Daniel Herschel and Marcus Taylor guilty of racketeering and fraud. These are the kinds of charges that are usually brought up against drug dealers and those types of folks. In this trial, many people who received immunity for testifying were in fact drug dealers testifying against police officers who described a rampant campaign of amazing criminal activity. Daniel Herschel and Marcus Taylor were the only two who decided to stand trial on the charges that had been levied against eight officers in total. Most of the rest of them pled guilty to the charges. Herschel and Taylor decided to stand trial in federal court, and they were found guilty, as I said, of racketeering and fraud. Tomorrow on Midday, my guest will be Baltimore Police Commissioner Designate Daryl D'Souza. We'll talk about the trial, which took place actually during a sharp decline in the number of homicides in our city. I mean, it's really quite astonishing that, but for the last 11 days, which is when this trial was taking place in the main, the trial lasted, oh gosh, about 3 weeks, we have had no homicides in the city of Baltimore. Erica Bridgeford and the organizers of the Baltimore Ceasefire started their third event, the third Baltimore Ceasefire, a week ago Friday, in which they hoped, as they have hoped on two other occasions, to stem the tide of violence, and they called for no shootings, no homicides for a period covering the weekend from Friday to Sunday. And in fact, that happened, but it extended 10 more days, now 11 more days. So we here are, as we speak today, at 11 days without a murder in the city of Baltimore. And as sad as it is to be happy about that, it is at least a step in the right direction. So Daryl D'Souza, of course, appointed by Mayor Catherine Pugh, who expressed frustration with the former police commissioner, Kevin Davis. She said it was her impatience about bringing the rate of murder and rate of violence down in Baltimore that led her to fire Kevin Davis and hire one of his deputy chiefs, Daryl D'Souza. He's been part of the police force for 30-some years. He has spent a good part of the last year or so in a special institute for police, learning best practices and the newest techniques of policing from departments around the country. And he is now the person in charge. There are folks who said that he's gotten off to something of a rough start. He had a few tough bolts out of the gate. He had some announcements that were later retracted and then put back in to play. And some of it's not quite clear. We're going to clear all of that up tomorrow when Daryl D'Souza, I'm very happy to say, will be my guest for the first half hour of Midday tomorrow. But we're going to begin today with the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson, whose latest documentary chronicles the history of historically black colleges and universities. The HBCU tradition in the United States was born out of necessity, animated after the Civil War by the conviction that education would be the foundation upon which the success of freedmen and freedwomen would be built. There are currently 101 HBCU schools, 20 fewer And back in the 1930s, its graduates include black luminaries like W.E.B. Du Bois, Thurgood Marshall, Spike Lee, Althea Gibson, Toni Morrison. Mr. Nelson's film is called Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of historically black colleges and universities. The film speaks of the history, the legacy, and the importance of HBCUs, not only to the black community, but to the whole of American society. So the film is set to premiere on Monday night on PBS. It's going to be screened at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum in Baltimore on Sunday afternoon, and Stanley Nelson joins us on the phone. Mr. Nelson, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This film is really poignant, very touching, very compelling. You wrote it, you produced it, you directed it. HBCUs, as we know them, are a phenomenon that began just after the Civil War with so-called missionary schools. What were they, and what was the impetus behind them?
Well, one of the things that happened right after the Civil War was over, that the formerly enslaved people really wanted to get an education. You know, education was denied people who were enslaved, and so that was looked at as kind of, you know, this holy grail. If we can just get an education, you know, things will change. So one of the things that happened was different missionary societies, white folks, there were some black people, but mainly white folks from the north went down into the south to educate and to set up schools, and that was one of the first ways that schools were set up. But one of the things that we talk about in the film, I think, that's very important is that, you know, there was agency on the part of the formerly enslaved people. You know, they were really pushing for this education and demanding it.
In fact, the title comes from a quote by a young man who's 13 years old, Richard Robert Wright, who was asked, what folks should tell, was it the federal government? He was asked what message should be delivered on behalf of the people who were forming these schools. And he said, tell them we are rising.
Right. And when we heard that story and that quote, we said, aha.
Yeah.
Here's the title of our film.
Yeah,
indeed. So there we go.
And, of course, in those early days, the resistance on the part of white racists, particularly in the South, was adamant and very violent. I mean, many of these places were burned down. Many of the people involved with them were subjected to violence, including some of the white teachers who decided to work and teach these black students.
Yeah, in the film, there's this wonderful, tragic story of a white teacher who has gone down south, and he's going to be lynched, and they give him a chance to write a letter home to his wife and kids, and he starts the letter with, my dear, I die tonight. And basically he writes her a letter that says, you know, I'm going to be lynched for coming down here and teaching Negroes how to read and write. And in fact, he is killed. And it's just an amazing story.
The film chronicles the vast sort of philosophical difference about how the schools should be structured and what they should aspire to between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, two, you know, towering figures in the history of African American culture. But tell us what Booker T. Washington's sort of stance was and how W.E.B. Du Bois differed from Washington in his outlook.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a fascinating story. I thought that Booker T. Washington is just an amazing and fascinating character because, you know, he was a slave, and he was freed as a young boy by the Civil War, and he becomes the head of Tuskegee Institute. And, you know, he is advocating what was called industrial education, which is basically, you know, education to for service, you know, to be, you know, a carpenter, a bricklayer, a expert painter, you know, that kind of work, which is, you know, admirable and wonderful work. But one of the things that's so fascinating about Booker T. is he becomes arguably the most famous and most powerful African-American in the country. And I thought that was just really a fascinating story because he is a college president, you know, and from his vantage as a college president, he becomes the most famous and powerful black man in the United States. And then his idea of industrial education kind of catches on, not only with the Southern planters who were like, "Aha, you know, this sounds like education we can go for," but also with Northern industrialists who are also, you know, hop on and they're pouring money into Booker T. Washington's various endeavors. And, you know, he gives this famous speech called the Atlanta Compromise in 1895, which basically says, you know, we will not advocate for civil rights. We will not advocate for political rights. We are here to do your service. We are here to lift ourselves up by our bootstraps, and it, you know, it may take 100 years, but we are willing to do that. And at that point, W.B. Du Bois and others say, well, wait a minute. You know, we need to be educated in the same way, in the classics, you know, in English, math, history, poetry, literature, excuse me, just like white folks. And that's what we're going to push for.
And in 1924 at Fisk University, interestingly, one of the daughters of W.E.B. Du Bois, Yolanda, was a student at Fisk. But Fisk was one of those examples of a black institution that was being run by a white president. And the white president in this case, a man named Fayette McKenzie, very strict with the rules regarding time that you could be walking around and time you had to be in your room and what you had to wear and what you had to do and all this stuff. And there was that led to a mini uprising, didn't it? Tell us that story.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. One of the things that is, again, central to the story is that, you know, up into the 20s, 30s, 40s even, and beyond, so many of these schools, black colleges and universities, were run by white people. They had white presidents, white boards. And Fayette McKenzie is the president of Fisk. And, you know, he institutes all these draconian rules, and for the first time, the black students kind of rise up, and they go on strike, and they refuse to go to class. And finally, he resigns. And it kind of sets this precedent that says, wait a minute, you know, we as students have power, and we can use that power, you know, if the administrations are not, you know, really focusing on our needs. And it sets up something that goes on at HBCUs from then on in.
You refer to the 1930s and 1940s in the film as the golden age of HBCUs. How come?
Well, you know, this is the chapter right after the story of Fisk and Fayette McKenzie. So at that point, other schools also rise up, and you have the schools, you know, being run more by African Americans, being more attuned to the needs of the students. But you have this era where these colleges are now fully not adhering to this idea of industrial education. You know, they're educating in very much the same way as majority white institutions. And they are pretty much the only place that African Americans can go. So you have the cream of the crop of students. You also have the cream of the crop of black faculty, because they're the only place that African Americans can teach. So even if you were one of the few, you know, the 5% or less that gets to go to, you know, Harvard or Yale or Stanford or Oberlin or wherever, you know, when you get out, if you want to teach, the only place that you can teach is at a black college. So they have the cream of the crop of professors, of African American professors, and it really is kind of this wonderful golden age of for black colleges and universities.
You also talk about the Howard University Law School, its most famous graduate, perhaps Thurgood Marshall. And one of the folks you feature in the movie, and forgive me, I can't remember who, says, "Nothing is more powerful than an idea whose time has come." And Marshall works to show the absurdity of the notion of separate but equal educational facilities. And he and a man named Charles Houston, who is a lawyer from Harvard University, who's running the Howard University Law School, take a trip down south and chronicle with film and their reporting about what was going on. And this, of course, leads to massive change in the legal system.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories. It's just an amazing story that, you know, Charles Hamilton Houston, who's an African-American lawyer who had graduated from Harvard, is appointed the head of the Howard Law School, and he totally revamps it. And I think the first graduating class was something like 9 people out of 36, you know, who were enrolled. There were 9 graduates. The rest washed out. Thurgood Marshall, after Thurgood Marshall graduates, they take a trip down south, and while they're there, they actually take pictures and take movies, motion picture film, and I have to say that one of the things that you see in these pictures, they had never been to the Deep South, so you know they're as shocked by the conditions as you know anybody else would be, as we would be. So they're shocked, and they take these incredible movies and incredible pictures of the conditions in the Deep South and bring them back and say, you know, here's what separate but equal really is. They, in one moving sequence in the film, we show the film that they took of white kids, you know, getting on the school bus, you know, and black kids, you know, running and walking down a long country road to get to school.
Yeah, those are incredibly powerful images, and they're just placed with such great poignancy and finesse. You also speak to a number of people who were involved in the Greensboro sit-in at the Woolworths there. These are students at North Carolina A&T, and you talk to a number of people who were involved in that movement, and a lot of folks forget about that particular event because it was, you know, some 5 years before the, you know, the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act and the sort of the big moments, or you know, 3 years before Dr. King spoke on the Mall in Washington. Dr. King gets, you know, deservedly a lot of attention for what happened during the Civil Rights Movement, but this was a really pivotal event.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why we really love that story is it's a story, you know, that couldn't have happened anywhere else except a black college. You know, you had 4 black students sitting around the dorm and saying, you know, why can't we go and sit and eat at Woolworths? You know, let's just go down there and we'll sit until we're served. You know, we'll just sit there. Let's just sit and we'll take what comes. We'll sit there. And they go and they sit there. And, you know, the next day, the women's school, Bennett College, the women from Bennett join them. And the next day, more and more. And it kind of sweeps across the South where there's sit-in movements all over the South, you know, at stores all over the South. And one of the things that's so amazing about this story is that, you know, it kind of quickly, you know, catches on and it quickly is successful because it hits at the economics of these stores. You know, people can't make any money, and so you know, and so they kind of cave in and you know, fairly quickly, for you know, compared to some of the other things that happened in the South, the stores are now integrated.
Yeah, you chronicle what happened at a department store in Atlanta called Riches, where you estimate that it cost Riches about $10 million in losses in the Christmas season in 1960 because of the protests there. So that's a pretty strong incentive for them to make some changes.
Yeah, and we really wanted to place that in the hands of the students who were going to HBCUs. I mean, that's really, you know, important, and I think that's one of the huge differences that you see in this film, is that we really wanted to center it in the fact that these were students, and that, you know, they led this successful protest.
Early on in the film, we see some really wonderful footage from Morris Brown College. And then at the end of the film, we see shots of Morris Brown College, but it's the stadium, the football stadium, to which we had been introduced earlier in the movie, which is now abandoned, strewn with debris and graffiti. There, as I mentioned at the very beginning, some 30 fewer HBCUs now than there were in the 1930s and 40s. What's your prognosis and speculation about the future of historically black colleges and universities?
Well, first, let me say that you know, that's just one of the most poignant pieces of the film to see, you know, Morris Brown. It's so visual to see the chain on the chapel, you know, the oldest building on campus, to see the graffiti in the stadium, the overgrown grass. And, you know, I should say that I went to Morris Brown for a term in my college career. Mm-hmm. So I lived there. I lived in the dorm that's all shattered and broken out. So I, you know, when I went back to visit, I said, "Oh, we just got to shoot this because it's just so visual. It's just so visual." But to answer your question about the prognosis, I mean, I think things are okay. You know, I mean, I think that HBCUs have struggled from the very beginning to do more with less, and I think they're still, you know, in some ways they're still doing that. There's been for many schools over the last couple of years an uptick in applications. I think that's because, you know, of what some people call the Missouri effect, from what happened at the University of Missouri, the outright racism that you know, students, black students are facing on campus, the highly racialized tenor and tone in this country right now, that many African-American young people are saying, you know, I just want to go someplace where I don't have to deal with race for 4 years, where I know that I'm not going to be judged by my race. So, you know, some schools are seeing an uptick. I think finances, you know, have always been a problem and are still a problem. But, you know, what I'm advocating is that we, you know, all support HBCUs. You know, I'm starting to tithe every month. I give a little bit of money every month to Negro College Fund, the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, and to support HBCUs. And I think that should go not only for African Americans, but everybody in this country. You know, I think when you see the film, you see how important black colleges and universities have been to all of us in this country. And I think that, you know, we need them now, probably just as much as we ever did.
Well, that's for sure. And the film, you're exactly right, makes a powerful argument about their importance and significance. Stanley Nelson is the writer, producer, and director of Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of black colleges and university. It premieres on PBS on Monday night. Check your local listings for the time. The Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture here in Baltimore will be screening the film Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, and we've got a link to details on our website, wipr.org/midday. Mr. Nelson, it's been an honor to talk to you. I've been a fan of your work, the Freedom Riders movie that you did, and the other things that you've done. And so it's really been a thrill to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
Next up, our foodie feature, What You Got Cooking? African-American culinary historian Michael Twitty and Chef David Thomas of Ida B's Table are going to join me after a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.